through her legendary political art, The Young Persons.
Welcome to Bibliocracy, KPFK's weekly literary arts show. I'm your host, Andrew Tonkovich, editor of the Santa Monica Review and founding editor of Citric Acid, Orange County's unlikeliest online arts journal. This show is produced by the Community of Writers, which hosts annual summer writers' workshops in addition to year-round programming, including the current online short course on the legendary poet Lucille Clifton. See communityofwriters.org for more information. My guest this week is Stephen F. Eisenman, who introduces and offers commentary to accompany the recent work produced by legendary artist Sue Coe in a small, perfect book titled Instructively, Provocatively, Helpfully, The Young Person's Illustrated Guide to American Fascism. Out now from OR Books, this beautifully produced volume is a primer and a guide, not only an interpretation of our political moment through Sue Coe's distinctive art, but a civics and history lesson that is smart, fun, sincere, and of course urgently necessary. I doubt that Sue Coe needs much introducing. I've been a fan of her drawing and illustration and comics for 40 years, since How to Commit Suicide in South Africa and X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. Sue Coe is, along with Art Spiegelman, one of the perhaps most obviously identifiable and celebrated political artists in the world, in the tradition of Daumier, the German Expressionists, and John Hartfield. My guest, Stephen F. Eisenman, is Professor Emeritus of Art History at Northwestern University and the author of a dozen books, including 19th Century Art, A Critical History, Gauguin's Skirt, The Abu Ghraib Effect, and The Cry of Nature, Art and the Making of Animal Rights. He is an art critic and columnist for Counterpunch and co-founder of the environmental justice nonprofit Anthropocene Alliance. Welcome to Bibliocracy, Stephen Eisenman.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I took quite a bit of joy in reading your bona fides along with Sue Coe's, and what really gave me a lot of joy, which I'll say is the perhaps the most fun way to introduce this book, is the most clear, gentle, and honest opener of any book for young people, well, all people, that I have read lately. And I've read a lot of books lately about fascism and anti-fascism, and yours goes like this. Before you read this book, it would be good to talk with family or friends about what democracy means to you. Fascism means the death of democracy, but you can't understand the first term without understanding the second. My God, Stephen, how long have I waited for these two lines, which, I'm sorry, the prestige press, the mainstream press, the legacy press can't bring themselves to do. Put those two words in the same sentence together, for crying out loud. So thank you for that. And what to say? That frames the mission of this entire book, right?
Yeah, I'm so glad you got it. It's funny, writing a book like that, the simplest things are the most difficult to come by. And that line came really at the end of the whole book, because I realized what was absent in any reader trying to understand what fascism means was to understand their own particular circumstances and the absence or presence of democracy in their lives. So only when you can appreciate whether or not you have access to democracy can you understand what its lack would mean if you engage, you become part of a regime of fascism.
It's almost like a yin-yang, or if you're not a spiritual or faith person. It's what we might call a dialectic, thank you very much. But it's almost impossible, it seems, until very recently, for mainstream scholars and the New York Times and for NPR to do what you just did. Now, thankfully, many of your colleagues, as it were, scholars and activists like Jeff Charlotte, Jason Stanley, even Timothy Snyder and others have this conclusion and are trying to introduce the discussion the way that you and, of course, Sue Coe have done it. The other way that you've done it, via the remarkable illustrations, drawings, and comics of Sue Coe, is through this sort of multi-form book. So you've got instructive essays, which are kind of explainers. You've got a definition of fascism and its history. And then there's this wonderful lexicon throughout. So you use phrases like proto-fascist and corporatist democracy. Some of your subtitles in your introduction are Ford, Hitler, and Mass Killing. And then my favorite, Fascist Avatar. Now, maybe you could elaborate on that, because I admire Federico Finkelstein's book where he calls Trump a wannabe fascist, but you and perhaps Sue Coe use the phrase, or you, at least you did before the inauguration, fascist avatar. Could you start a little bit with that introduction? What does that say for you?
I guess I was trying to get across Trump's unwillingness to be clear about what his ideological posture is, but his willingness to accept any ascription of the most far-right tendencies that are out there. So he could embrace the Proud Boys, he could make common cause with Viktor Orban, the so-called illiberal or proto-fascist or fascist president of Hungary. He could embrace Jair Bolsonaro, the openly fascist president of Brazil until he was voted out and then recently indicted. All that was grist for Trump's mill, and therefore he seemed to see the power that a fascist leader had and wanted more of it. In that sense, he was a fascist wannabe. I call him a fascist avatar, an embodiment of fascism. Now that he's been reelected, we hear he's the fascist in chief. Part of the book, however, is not to indicate that fascism is an entirely new phenomenon in the United States. There's a long history of fascism going back really to the founding of the United States. I don't want to so disempower the word as to say that it's everywhere. If you say that, then fascism means nothing. But there are elements of the American political experiment that have been fascist from the start. We need to be aware of those to understand where Trump fits in within that and how his being a fascist avatar is to bring together all those past fascist elements and crystallizing them into something more powerful, disturbing, and dangerous.
And that is indeed a glimpse into the 30-page introduction to the book, which includes dozens and dozens of Sue Coe's illustrations, drawings, comics, The Young Person's Illustrated Guide to Fascism. Stephen, you said something there again that I wish people had said 4, 8, 12 years ago, which is this weird, perfect fascist strategy or polemic or whatever it is, where it's so perverse. Almost anything you say about Trump is available. It's there. It's true. It's like he has this little shopping basket and it gets thrown in there. And if you want to call it out, you can, or you can just ignore it. It's the wrestling metaphors. It's the hostility toward LGBTQ folks and other people who've been historically marginalized. It's the wink, wink, we're telling the truth, but we're not telling the truth. And I'm just so grateful that you've given people a way to kind of sift through it all, along with the revisionist history of the U.S. as a country that's always been struggling to figure out its relationship to democracy by way of not, hopefully, being a fascist state. Ostensibly, this book, Stephen Eisenman, is written for young people, but it's a wonderful resource for people who, how shall we say, didn't get this instruction in K through 12 community college or even a four-year college. So I'm not only giving it to my kid and to young people, but I'm giving it to grown-ups because, forgive me, I never got a class on Fascism 101 in high school or college. Did you?
No, but I did grow up in a household in which World War II was an omnipresence. Now, my father fought in the Second World War, and on the TV at the time, there were all these programs, World at War, and my bookshelves in my house were filled with books about the war. Yeah, so in that sense, I did have that education. The United States, so one thing I just want to highlight, though, is that the United States does embrace democratic ideas at its founding, but it also has this basic flaw that is slavery and genocide. And these are two big flaws, obviously, and both of those are aspects of the fascism, the most destructive fascisms of the 20th century. So the United States, with slavery and with its elimination of attempted elimination of indigenous people, went down the path that would later be gone down by Mussolini and Hitler, and of course other of his allies, Franco in Spain, others in Paraguay and in Chile later on. So those kinds of paths had been trodden earlier and were understood by those fascist leaders to have been premonitions of the fascism that they would develop. So I just to backtrack again, I did actually grow up with some cognizance of fascism and Nazism, and that made me, I think, more aware of the fascisms that exist within the United States political history as well.
And that's a lens that's not often, how shall we say, looked through or applied. I'll also say if young readers and older readers and any readers could learn some of the vocabulary from this book, which is also a kind of lexicon, if we could start introducing into our conversations the phrases, the concepts that you use, the two most important being political economy and perhaps free market capitalism or neoliberalism and Christian nationalism, those two concepts which inform the new right, the alt-right, and forgive me, the fascist right, we'd all be better off if we could talk and think like Steven Eisenman, and if we could talk and think like Sue Coe Draws, we'd really be able to have a conversation. And that's one of the terrific things about the book. One of the terrific things about being able to host this show is that we get to hear the voice of the writer. And I've invited Steven Eisenman to read a couple of exemplary excerpts from the book. And these are texts which are almost like didactics that go along with the pieces. They're informed commentaries which help the reader along in terms of more fully appreciating and apprehending the gorgeous and startling and just, you know, iconic work of Sue Coe. And the first one, Stephen, I think you've agreed to read is called The Artist as Political Thinker, which does so much to explain and introduce my hero and yours, Sue Coe.
The Artist as Political Thinker. Sue Coe has been making political art for more than 50 years, since she received a master's degree at the Royal College of Art in London and moved to New York City. Her knowledge of her subjects, U.S. politics, war, domestic violence, human and animal oppression, public health, environmental degradation, civil rights, is broad and deep, but it's the understanding of a well-read artist, not a politician or a professor. Consider two lino cuts, chock-a-block with images and ideas. One of them is JBS Climate Butcher, and another is Stock Market. In the first print, some animals are seen drowning while others row towards safety in a flooded world. Billboards of hamburgers and fried chickens remind us that animal agriculture is one of the major culprits in global CO2 increases and rising sea levels. The moon and sun fight like debating politicians while cities are inundated. In the second print, we see a trading floor crammed with men. Their mouths are agape and their hands clutch at anything with exchange value. Stocks and bonds, dollars, rubles, bitcoin, gold. In the middle of it all is a medallion are coined of an inestimable value, representing nature that has not yet been plundered. The suggestion is that it will be soon. The commonweal is to be privatized. Not all of Sukho's art is so agitated or crammed with stuff as this. Some is straightforward, even spare, with the clarity of a declarative sentence. A boy stays the hand of a little girl, reaching down to touch something lying amid flowers. The title of the work reads, "Don't Touch," and the legend below, "Children Against Cluster Bombs." Another print titled, "He Incites Fascist Violence," shows Trump holding up a Bible, as he did on June 1, 2020, in front of St. John's Episcopal Church near the White House, soon after cops violently cleared civil rights protesters from nearby Lafayette Park. The protesters are shown by Sue on their knees, with arms raised and fists clenched. Despite the tear glass, they have pulled aside their anti-COVID masks, the better to be heard.
Hey, thanks for that, Stephen Eisenman. It's like getting your own personal docent on a walkthrough of a Sukho gallery space. We really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And of course, you're the art historian here, so I leave it to you. But what is so brilliant about Sukho is the logic of her composition. So she combines a kind of poet's metaphorical vision with a mathematician's ability to assemble the quotidian. And she does it with like as few as two or three elements that should be assembled in all of our brains. But thankfully, she does it for us and just presents it right there. It's so immediately easy to apprehend. I mean, is it possible that even fascists would understand and laugh and appreciate what she's doing?
I hope they wouldn't laugh. I hope they'd feel they'd been attacked and they'd feel fear. There's nothing that hurts a fascist more than being teased or made fun of. I should say that her work in that way, as you describe it, is like caricature. And caricature works like a joke. A joke like a caricature is a shortcut. It takes two or three ideas and makes a fast way between them, a fast track between them, so you can shortcut all the nonsense in between. And that's what a caricature does. That's what her best drawings do.
Oh, thanks for doing that. That's why you get the big money, Stephen Eisenman, for bringing in the definitional and the historical and reminding us how the art works. Can I just ask, how were you so lucky or talented or brilliant to become friends with Sukho? You collaborated on two, at least, previous books. One is called American Fascism Now, and the other American Fascism Still. Oh my gosh, both of those certainly helpfully introduce your thesis. Well,
we also did a book called Zoocide about the power of animals and about animal resistance to their oppression.
And so how do you know Sukho?
Well, you know, I've known her for now 30 years, I guess, and I ran into her first in her own gallery, San Etienne Gallery on 57th Street, New York City. I went up there to look at some works by Katie Kollwitz, the great German expressionist artist, and there, as it happened, Sukho was exhibiting her works and giving a kind of presentation about them. And it was a series of works called Porkopolis about slaughterhouses. And I sat there at the time, a meat eater, and I was struck by the works and by her words, and I was shamed. I realized that I was a meat eater and I enjoyed hamburgers like anybody else, but the cruelties to which animals are subject that she described made me feel like I should change my ways. And within 5 or 6 years, I gradually became vegetarian, and then I became vegan, and then an animal rights activist, and now quite adamant in my abolitionism, my belief that animals should not be used for any purposes other than their own pleasure and ability to live a fulfilling life.
And honestly, I think your experience with Sukho is parallel to many people's, where they've not only embraced a political position, but it's become manifest in their daily political lives, their political practices.
Sure.
That's a beautiful story. We have time to talk a little bit more, but most importantly, to ask Stephen Eisenman to read one more short explainer or commentary on Sue Coe's work as it is presented in The Young Person's Illustrated Guide to American Fascism. And this one is called Political versus, quote, Expressive Art and the End of Art.
Yeah, I just want to preface it briefly by saying that there's a lot of debate among artists about what constitutes political art, and lots of artists claim to be political artists. But to me, a political artist is only somebody who really aims to intervene in the domain of power. So it isn't. So that's where I make a distinction between political art versus simply expressive art. So let me read this with a little more detail then. Political art should be distinguished from expressive art. The former stages or makes possible an intervention into the domain of power, while the latter merely announces a position. The latter is far more common than the former. But the opportunity for artists to make a political intervention is greater than it may seem. Karl Marx once wrote, quote, "The weapons of criticism cannot, of course, replace criticism by weapons. Material force must be overthrown by material force. But theory also becomes a material force as soon as it has gripped the masses," end quote. Substitute the words political art for criticism and theory, and the meaning of the passage in this context becomes clear. If a political artist produces something sufficiently incisive and engaging, it may serve to galvanize the masses and stir them to action. It isn't only hunger, anger, and fear that sustain social movements. It is also understanding, imagination, and desire. That's especially true during times of upheaval or revolution, when the social mass is already primed for action. Sue Coe sets great store by this idea. She is one of the few major artists who is consistently engaged with social or political movements, human and animal rights, environmental justice, gender equality. Her art is also genuinely popular. To make sure it is seen, Coe publishes prints in relatively large editions and sells them for prices that ordinary people can afford. You can buy an original print for her for as little as $60. She also sometimes makes posters, billboards, and even the occasional T-shirt from her original art. These translations from one medium to another aren't works of kitsch that condescend to their audience. They're efforts at creating popular art that meets its audience halfway and raises its level of understanding and empathy. For Sue Coe, the threat of fascism in the U.S. is more than just abstract. Her art focuses on those who are exploited and abused, decries state-sanctioned violence, whether perpetrated by the U.S. military or private individuals, enabled by far-right politicians. It celebrates physical nature and attacks the corporations that are destroying it. It embraces the varieties of human culture, gender, and sexuality, and proposes that land and resources be shared by humans and animals alike. The name for such a system of mutuality, abundance, and sustainability is democracy, and its prospects, along with the art that supports it, will be dimmed or destroyed if fascism is allowed to prevail.
Another helpfully defining moment in the essay commentary by my guest this week on bibliocracy, Stephen Eisenman. It would be wrong for us not to celebrate Sue Coe just a little bit more. On a previous presentation that you gave with her, I wrote this down because it was so important for me, because Sue Coe is at the same time ironic, hilariously funny, in addition to being sincere and genuine, and of course, producing her art for all the reasons that you outlined. But she said something in the idiom, I think, which I appreciate most. She said, "Regarding fascism, I know one when I see one." And I just thought, maybe recklessly or youthfully, and since I've been admiring Sue Coe for 40 years, I haven't been shy about calling out fascism, maybe over exuberantly or maybe again recklessly. But can you elaborate just a little bit on why we've been forbidden to use that phrase, even perhaps imprudently on occasion, but why maybe it's time to interrogate and examine and define and maybe apply it once in a while?
Right. Well, there's good and bad reasons for that. The good reason for us not using it too much is that it is a very powerful word, and it describes something violent, dangerous, destructive, and indeed horrific. What happened before and after during the Second World War is something that should never be forgotten, and the perpetrators should never be forgiven. And the words fascism describe that, and we must be careful with that word. It's like dynamite. So I'm glad, and of course, and too often in the 60s, you know, well-meaning lefties would call, you know, President Johnson a fascist, and there may have been elements in his fascism, and a fascism, that is, his destruction, a truly genocide of Vietnamese, but otherwise not. So there are good reasons to be careful with the word. On the other hand, when it arises, and when somebody fits the bill, when it fits the definitions of fascism that scholars have arrived at, historians have arrived at, then it's best to call it out. There is a question as to whether calling Trump or anybody else a fascist is efficacious right now. He's been called so many things, including a felon, a congenital liar, a pathological narcissist. Calling him a fascist is just one more thing rolls off his back. I'm not sure it will have much impact. So I have to say, while I agree with you, we should call things by their names. Whether this will actually help coalesce opposition or harm him in any way, cause people to look at historical fascism to see the parallels with the present, will that be powerful, effective? The time will tell.
Well, it's certainly powerful and effective in the book that you've collaborated with Sue Coe on. And for the moment, in the early part of the Trump administration, I'm going to start using your phrase, fascist avatar, because at least as a kind of put a pin in that sort of label, it's very helpful to me. And your thoughtful and careful and scholarly examination of that phrase certainly helps me out personally. Just to say once again, this is a must-have book. You should buy it for the young person of any age in your life. It's called The Young Person's Illustrated Guide to American Fascism, with, of course, the startling and always rewarding art of Sue Coe and the helpful commentary by Stephen F. Eisenman. The Young Person's Illustrated Guide to American Fascism. It's such a joy to talk to you, and thanks so much, Stephen Eisenman, for being my guest this week on Bibliocracy.
Thank you, Andrew. I was really glad to be here.
Thanks to my guest this week, and thanks to you for listening to this edition of a show dedicated to reading, writing, and conversation about the literary arts. To learn about past guests and to hear recent programs, visit the Bibliocracy Radio website at bibliocracyradio.org. Thanks to engineer Mark Maxwell. And yes, if you support the wide range of arts and culture programming offered on KPFK and the work of your people-powered radio station, please support KPFK. And do join me next week for another edition of Bibliocracy.
Oh, the ink is black, the page is white. Together we learn to read and write, to read and write. And now a child can understand, this is the law of all the land, all the land. Oh, the ink is black, the page is white. Together we learn to read and write.
This is Nick, host of Bike Talk Online at KPFK since 2008. I used to have a car. But you don't need a car to get around LA. And we talk about that every episode.
Just do it!
I donated my car to KPFK, called 877-KPFK-AUTO. They took it away. Tax deduction. Anyone can have their car taken away. Cars, boats, motorcycles, any fossil fuel vehicle. Leaf blowers, not a vehicle. Call 877-KPFK-AUTO